It was just really wonderful, especially after that season of becoming new parents. That was just the perfect, refreshing vacation. And so, definitely one that stands out in my mind as one of my favorites.
Yeah, it is breathtaking. And as you're driving up to the Grand Canyon, and you don't even see it because it's not above your vision. It's you get right there, and then you can see this beautiful, beautiful scenic view.
Well, Arizona, I live in Arizona, so I'm grateful for that answer, doctor. If you ever come back, I'd love to meet you. And Arizona is just you could sunbathe and ski in the same day, because we drive north for a couple hours. We're in Flagstaff, and there's snow, and the Grand Canyon is beautiful. Antelope Canyon, right on the border of Utah, is just amazing. Some of the most picturesque places in America are right here in Arizona. And I'm going to be in a t-shirt today. I don't know about you two in Washington and Minnesota, but I'm going to be enjoying the weather outside. My wife and I are going to Canyon Lake after the interview today, and we're going to enjoy that. So I think all our technology is working. So I think people are here, and we'd like to jump right into the interview. This is a tough subject. This is one of those like third rails in Christianity, at least in America, I believe. I think it also creates friction in the way people talk about this. Now, doctor, you have this advantage. I think we've talked about this before, and you see yourself as kind of like a bridge, or at least your calling as kind of like a bridge, because you, like Moses, had a foot in both worlds, the Hebrew world and the Egyptian world. You are a scientist, but you're also a co-founder of a church. You're in ministry with your husband, and you're a very devout Christian. So maybe I'm going to let you share how you feel the current state is. Among, at least let's keep it to our shores. What is the current state when it comes to climate science and the acceptance of it among evangelical Christians or all Christians here in America?
Sure. And I just want to affirm, yes, it does feel like a third rail and one of those issues where sometimes it's just easier, or even most of the time, it feels just easier just not to touch it. Let's just not even talk about it. And I can tell you, as for myself, I'm not a third rail kind of person naturally. I got into climate science and being a scientist because of my faith in Christ. Because I, as a young Christian, wanting to serve God and partner with Him, asking Him, Lord, what can I do? What is your special assignment for me in partnering with you in bringing your kingdom? And lo and behold, he answered with a call to study earth sciences, which led to me becoming a climate scientist. And I don't think this is not something I would have stepped into without the prompting of the Lord and just being obedient to what he's calling me into. And so that's part of my story of just. It can feel a bit scary to have this conversation. And that's because, to your question of what is the current state of climate acceptance amongst Christians? What can we as Christians, how should we approach this issue? And what I have found personally, but then this is also backed up by social science research of surveys, asking this question to lots of different Christians across the country, is this is what I found. What I found is that most folks aren't sure what to think about, but when they look out their door, they do see that in the last 5, 10 years, something is different with the weather patterns that we've been seeing. Something is different with the storms that we're seeing. We're not used to seeing as much flooding, drought, wildfires. Something is up. People realize that, but they're not sure. What I find from chatting with my fellow Christians, they're not sure what to think about. That's the vast majority of people who I encountered. And the social science research backs this up in the sense that there's a perception gap of where people expect to people recognize the reality of climate change, that it is happening, but they think everyone else thinks it's a very contentious topic. And so just not wanting to bring it up because of that, because of the feeling that if they bring this up in conversation, they're going to start a controversial conversation. And so everyone's just kind of standing around quietly, seeing the same thing, recognize the same thing, that something is not right with our climate, but being afraid to share that in our Christian circles, because oftentimes the loudest voices in the room are saying and are telling us that we as Christians can't accept climate science, even though we're seeing those changes before our eyes. And so that's why I think having this conversation is so important, and I'm so happy to be here to have it.
So what's the difference between climate and weather?
Great question. So this is how I like to think about it. Weather is when you go to your closet, what do you choose each day to pull out? Is it a cold day? We're going to pull out a jacket. Is it a warm day? We're going to put on shorts and a t-shirt. Climate is, and that change in for weather, it changes day to day. For climate, it's your wardrobe. It's your seasonal wardrobe. So what season are we in? Do I have mostly warm weather clothes in my closet? Do I have mostly cold weather clothes in my closet? And so what we see this long term is the long term average of those weather patterns, whereas weather is those short term changes day to day. And so what we see is with climate change is that when we typically would expect, say, to have a cold weather closet wardrobe for this time of year, if you looked back over 10 years, 20 years, you might see a shift of, I used to have 20 years ago, a lot more parkas in my cold weather closet for January. But today, 20 years in the future, I'm not pulling out that parka as much. I am pulling out a light jacket. And that's what climate change is, that slow change and the average temperatures we should expect over time. Whereas we see large changes in weather day to day. In winter, sometimes we have those warm days. So we pull out, some warm weather gear. But overall, the climate is, what's that wardrobe look like, and how does that change over time?
I don't think we ever in Minnesota don't need a parka in January.
I hope it stays that way.
there's a kind of a satire group, the Minnesotans for Global Warming, which I find kind of funny, even though I understand the subject is serious. But, you know, we have some of those cold days that
Strange things with global warming is that especially we're seeing the biggest changes in our winters, which are making them mild and more seasonable. And so we can feel like, ooh, this feels nice. But it's really a harbinger of what's to come in the summer, and seeing warmer springs, hot summers, warmer falls, which is wreaking havoc with all of our expectations, whether that's for agriculture of when to plant, whether that's expectations for seeing stronger summer storms, or just not being prepared for that weather to come that's supercharged by climate change. But those warm winters can kind of lull us into this false sense of, wow, this is nice.
Right. Yeah. No, we have had a really, really hot, dry summer and late warm fall too. I don't recall, I mean, certainly not when I was growing up, I wouldn't have been wearing shorts in October. And yet this year, probably half of the days so far in October were warm enough for shorts. And that's unusual. Pleasant from my perspective, but not when you look at the big picture, right?
Well, let me build on that a little bit about the pleasantness. Doctor, I've heard you and others in climate science suggest that there's kind of three phases or three reactions to the controversy. And at first, people deny it. It's not happening. It's, you know, it's a hoax. It's propaganda. And the second phase is like, well, it is happening, but there's nothing we can do about it. It's bigger than us. It's not human caused. And, you know, climate always changes. And we've gone through periods where Iceland was green and Greenland was ice. And we're just going through another period like that, like what Christine suggested, that maybe this is something that's just, you know, outside of our purview. And then the third reaction is, okay, it is happening, but we don't know that it's bad. It could be good. It could lead to Minnesotans wearing shorts in October and maybe more bountiful economies in places that can't grow anything now and so forth. So what is your reaction to those three phases, and particularly the one that Christine just brought up, the idea that, okay, if it is happening, how do we know that it's not going to be good?
Yeah, I just want to first just say that all of these questions and positions are good questions to ask. They're so good that this is what my colleagues and I in climate science, we've asked each of these three questions. And the good news is that with all of those, that question asking, we've got a lot of good answers too, which is really exciting. And even to that, the second one, if I may, the how do we know this isn't part of a natural cycle, that it's just, how do we know that it's us? Because climate has changed in the past, rightly so. That is actually a Nobel Prize winning question that just won the Nobel Prize this year in physics. So these are good questions. And so let me address all three fairly quickly first. Is this a hoax? Is this just propaganda? Well, I'll say as a climate scientist, but more so just as a person and as a Christian and someone who loves my friends, my family, my community, I really wish that I could say that, yes, this is just a hoax, that it's not real, that it's propaganda, but that simply is not true, unfortunately. And as someone who does love my community, loves my family, and loves myself, knowing that climate change is real, that means that we need to pay attention. We can't just bury our heads in the sand because we don't like the reality that is facing us. But I can tell you, my climate scientist colleagues and I, if that was true, would be the first ones to be relieved if this was some global conspiracy. But unfortunately, it's not. To the second question, how do we know that it's us? How do we know that this isn't just a natural cycle? Because yes, the climate has changed in the past. Well, this is my purview. This is the science that I have particularly been studying in climate science, is past climate changes. And how do we know that climate change today is different from all those climate changes in the past? And so this is what my colleagues and I do in our research, is you can kind of think about it as a crime scene investigation of where we look at all of the different reasons climate changed in the past, the different culprits. And we can see, we can look at geologic records. We can use our state-of-the-art computer models, using all the best tools and technology available to us, and begin to do that forensic analysis. Are these culprits at play? Is the sun changing in intensity? Is this was part of the ice age cycles? Is there increased volcanic activity that is putting more carbon dioxide heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere and making it warmer? And so what we do is we have looked back at each of those culprits and tested them out. And time again, of all of these independent analyses from scientists in their own independent labs across the globe, looking at this same question from all the different angles, have been able to rule out, no, the sun's intensity is not getting, the sun's not getting stronger, making us warmer. It's actually, over the past 50 years, been getting slightly less intense as we've seen temperatures warm. Well, is this part of the ice age cycles? No, we see that actually we should be getting slightly cooler. We're at the peak of a warm phase in the ice age cycle, and we should slowly over the next several centuries be getting cooler, instead of seeing this dramatic warming that we've seen in both the weather station meteorological records. We shouldn't be headed in that direction if we're looking at the ice age cycles. Is it volcanic activity, which has been one of the main culprits of large past climate changes throughout Earth's history? And we can look around that, yes, we've got a little bit of volcanic activity going on, but not to the level that we'd expect to drive this warming. And actually, to the converse, the volcanic activity that we're seeing not only releases carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, but also releases another compound called, looking at sulfur. And that is actually a reflecting compound that for a very short amount of time makes us a little bit cooler because it's reflecting out the sun's rays. And so we can rule out all of these culprits. And what is left is, yes, carbon dioxide, a heat-trapping gas, is driving this climate change, but we see the chemical fingerprint for human activity on it instead of volcanic activity or natural processes. That really helps us answer those questions.
One quick follow-up, and then I'm going to let Christine jump back in. And that is, one of the ways that people dismiss, or the detractors of global warming or climate change dismiss it, is they try and suggest that there's experts on both sides, and that there really isn't a conclusive understanding. We're still figuring it out. Rush Limbaugh, when he was still with us, he'd speak to a climate scientist, and the climate scientist would seem to ally with the Prager University side that this is really an economic political thing to redistribute money. So let me ask you in this way: when that controversy with the East Anglia emails came out, and people said that hockey stick graph was doctored and so forth, what really is the feeling? What really is the percentage of climate scientists who accept anthropogenic global warming? Is it 50-50? Is it 80-20? What is the percentage, and how do you respond to people when they bring up something like East Anglia or the hockey stick graph?
Yeah, that's a great and timely question, because we've got a new updated number, and it's actually not 97% of climate scientists, is actually now 99% of climate scientists and climate research publications affirm and find that climate is changing and that it is caused by our human activity. And so many of the studies that are in that 1%, whenever you look at the studies themselves, how they were designed, there are some fatal flaws in them. And so just to state clearly, 99% of climate science research studies and climate scientists find that climate change is happening because of us. And I think an important way of thinking about this is, if we were going to a doctor's office, if we were going to the dentist, and they told us that we had some condition, and that 99% of their fellow doctors or dentists agreed, that would be a very strong signal that, yes, we need to pay attention. This is real. This is real. We're listening to the 99% and not the one outlier that is out there. And that is what's really hard in the media, is that you can have that one outlier come on a show and say whatever their reasons are, but it's not backed up by the body of evidence of research, this really strong, robust, decades-long, even centuries-long body of research. And I'll just also say, this gets at the nature and methods of science, as well as the how science, the scientific enterprise operates. And I've been part of every stage of that scientific discovery enterprise, from doing the research myself. You mentioned the hockey stick. So there's not just one record, not just the hockey stick, that shows throughout the past 10,000 years of where over the span of modern civilization, that we have been at a stable climate. And then all of a sudden, right, as the Industrial Revolution happens and our use of fossil fuels, oil, gas, coal for our energy, that we then see this dramatic rise in CO2 as well as temperature. There's not just one record that shows that. It is hundreds and hundreds of scientists across the globe going and getting these geologic records, putting them all together from different archives. The hockey stick is made of tree rings. We've got also the ice core records. I work specifically with cave stalagmites and lake sediments. And we put all of those records together. And as a scientific team, say, what are they together telling us? And it reaffirms that hockey stick. So it's not just one person, one scientist, one lab finding it. It's all over the entire globe telling the same story. And that's what, for me, science is simply studying God's creation. And as a scientist, I have the opportunity to look for clues in God's creation and ask and inquire and investigate what is the story that it's telling us. And over, as my colleagues and I have done this, it's telling the same consistent story that climate change is real, that it's not like climate changes in the past, and it's our human activity. And if I could just add like a little spin on that, that is good news. It is good news that it's not a natural cycle. It's good news that it's us because it means that we can do something about it. And I am just so heartened that God, the creator of the universe, has also instilled in us that creative, innovative spirit that comes from Him, because we have and are able to create the technology, the tools, the know-how to address this. So it is, as a past climate researcher, I'm just here to say that it's good news that climate change today is not a natural cycle and that we can do something about it that will make our world a cleaner, a safer, and healthier place by acknowledging and looking to the solutions of climate change.
Wow, that does sound like good news. So, I know some people feel like when we start talking about climate change, the solutions are big government, and there's concern by some people that I know that this big government solution will be wasteful and inefficient. Are those the only solutions, or what other things could we consider?
Yeah, and that's where the good news is also that those aren't the only solutions. I do believe that government is part of the solution, but the markets are part of the solution. Us as individuals are part of the solution. Our churches are part of the solution. There are, when I look at how do we address climate change, what I see is a buffet of different solutions. And being able to pick and choose and craft together that perfect plate that is the right way that takes into consideration a whole lot of different factors when it comes to addressing climate change. And I do think in the past, though, that has been one of the problems is that this has been a very partisan topic, and where we had liberals and conservatives on either side of the coin, with liberals being more seen as a partisan liberal issue. And so because of that, we only got liberal partisan solutions. But the thing is that there's really great conservative solutions to climate change. There's public-private partnerships to solutions to climate change, market-based solutions to climate change. And so what I'm seeing now, which really gives me a lot of hope for the future, is that it's the political temperature on climate change is starting to get dialed down. We are beginning to see conservative politicians, conservative leaders begin to offer their own solutions to climate change. We're beginning to see businesses propose their own solutions to climate change. And this is where I think the debate really needs to be, not about the science, because the science is very clear about what's going on. The debate should be in the solution space of what is the right way to address address climate change, because we've got to get this right, and we need all voices, a diversity of voices, to come to the table and bring their solutions so that we can make sure that as we address climate change, that it also doesn't have unintended consequences in different communities, or just focusing on one type of solution, which is solely government driven. And that's what I'm excited about for this moment in time, is we're beginning to see that full buffet that's out there. We're beginning to see that in its totality.
Recently, Steven Pinker was on with Michael Shermer, and this subject came up. And he too mentioned the overwhelming scientific evidence for climate change. And the idea, I think Shermer kind of posed the question to him, then where's the disconnect then? If the evidence is just so overwhelming and they both accept it, why isn't there more of an urgency in the whole of the political spectrum or the public? And Pinker suggested that some of the blame lands with the scientists and the way that you have tried to persuade the public, and the fact that it was so tied to Al Gore early on, and Al Gore's documentary and so forth. And he was, you know, a kind of a polarizing figure. So let me ask you a kind of a pointed question. Why is there this discrepancy between what the scientists clearly accept? You said it's overwhelming, but it's also global. And we've seen the same thing happen with the coronavirus. I mean, we've seen Americans suggest that the coronavirus is just a hoax to bring down a president, when they didn't really think to realize that this is happening everywhere. It's not just happening in America. So how do you get Americans to think outside of that box of partisanship? And how much blame really does lie with the scientific community, and possibly a weakness in communicating the overwhelming evidence you've suggested?
Yeah, I think one of the big problems is, or at least with anything, it matters who the messenger is if we're going to receive that message. And so I think there has been a trust problem, and you really nail it, of with Al Gore being the primary messenger a decade ago, as we began to see climate change impacts really, pun not intended, really heating up, that only a segment of the American population felt ready to trust what he had to say. And the problem was, is there wasn't another trusted messenger who could reach the other half of Americans that was saying that. And so, again, that gets at the hyper-partisan nature that climate change has inhabited in the past. Again, we're beginning to see that change. However, there is a delegation of Republican congresspeople going to the COP26 meeting in Glasgow with the UN Climate Conference, the Global UN Climate Conference. There are Republicans going there to offer their own solutions, not to bring a message that climate change isn't happening, but coming to offer their solutions for how we address it. And so that is something that was lacking whenever Al Gore made his message, got his message out in 2008, 2007. And so in the last decade, by having it being a one-sided conversation, that is the legacy that we've had of continuing that partisan debate. I'm glad to see that that's shifting. When it comes to scientists, the other misstep there was that as scientists in the scientific community, we really rest on let the facts speak for themselves. That's how we communicate to each other as scientists, trying to just put the facts out there and judge something on its scientific merits, the merits of the data. Well, the thing that as scientists we forgot that it, you know, you can look at a chart, you can look at a graph, and it doesn't communicate the full story in the sense of something that really grabs us, that cuts through how big the problem of climate change is. We've essentially been just talking to each other in the headspace, instead of, we've got to address the heart space as well and begin to communicate, why does this matter to me and my family? We kept the conversation at a global level and frankly, keeping it at an abstract level to the point that it felt like this is a problem that is far in the future. It's not in my hometown, it's somewhere else across the globe, and it kept that it distant. That was the perception of the way that it was communicated, that this is a distant problem. We've got so many other problems that we're dealing with in the here and now. Our dance card is full. We don't have the capacity to address this problem. We've got what feels like all these other pressing problems happening right now. Well, the problem is that, and as we have seen in our own communities, especially in the last 5, 6, 7 years, that climate change is happening right now. We're seeing climate-fueled extreme weather, stronger hurricanes, longer, more frequent droughts, more devastating floods that are hitting our homes and communities, not only on the coastlines, but also in the heartland and middle America. And we're having to learn that lesson the hard way. And I think just even recently, last week, a study came out that 85% of people across the globe have already experienced a taste of climate change, of where you can see that detectable influence of climate on the weather patterns that they are experiencing. And so we are seeing that climate change is not a distant threat. It's happening in the here and now. And if I could just share just a little story, a personal story, from myself as a climate scientist, I've been studying this myself, and I even found myself falling in that line of thinking that that it's over there, it's someone else's problem, it's a problem I care about, but it's not going to touch me. Well, 5 years ago, in 2016, I grew up in East Tennessee. In this season, in the fall, we were experiencing an extreme drought, an exceptional drought of months without rain that left our usually lush East Tennessee forests, the Great Smoky Mountains, it left it tinder dry. And so when a spark fell, it just exploded and caused a wildfire in the Great Smoky Mountains and outside the tourist town of Gatlinburg, Tennessee, caused that fire to become something that we had really never seen on the East Coast in East Tennessee, something that you really only hear about and see out west. And that fire ripped through the national park, ripped through Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and actually destroyed a family home of ours that was really near and dear to all of us. I was very lucky. None of my family members were there at the time, but 14 people lost their lives. And you can, we can look to see that that extreme drought created those conditions for this, you could call it a perfect storm, but it's, we know that it's not by chance. We know that the dice were loaded to begin to see something that we'd never seen before happen. And I, as a climate scientist, realized that I've been personally impacted by climate change. And I lost that family home. And it's not only the property that was lost. What was lost was the memories that I had in that home, especially with my grandparents, memories that I can't photos, pictures, things that I can't get back. I also lost that ability to take my own children to that cabin so that I could share those memories and with them firsthand. And so what the real story is that climate change isn't some distant thing in the future. It's here and now, and it's impacting things in our lives that are irreplaceable. And that's why I'm really dedicated as a climate scientist to have this difficult conversation, because I don't want anyone else to experience the loss that I experienced or worse.
It seems that you're suggesting that the conversation has changed over the last decade from is climate change happening, to that, what do we do about it? So are you suggesting that the controversy now really kind of revolves around not necessarily the observations of what's happening, but the conclusions as to how to deal with it. And what separates the two sides of the issue? Is it male, female? Is it how much you make? Is it the political party you belong to, or the church you go to? What does the data suggest is keeping people from actually being proactive about it once they accept it?
Sure. And the real defining line, at least in the past, and the good news is we're beginning to see this change, but the predominant factor of whether someone accepted the reality of climate change really did fall along political lines. And again, that reflects how partisan the climate change conversation has been. So if someone identified more with a progressive liberal ideology, overwhelmingly accepted the reality. If someone aligned more with a conservative political identity, would be less likely to recognize and accept, or just actually be unsure. They may be just more unsure about whether climate change is happening because they're not sure who to trust, what information is trustworthy. But again, we're beginning to see that shift. And I think the big reason is because so many people have their own climate change weird weather story of where it's really hit home. It's not just seeing the evidence of it isn't just on a chart or graph anymore. It's something that we're experiencing in our lives, and people are looking for those solutions. And so one exciting thing that we're also seeing a shift towards is when we look at solutions like affordable clean energy that not only reduces the amount of carbon dioxide that's being released using that energy, of using low carbon sources, it not only cuts back on those carbon emissions, it also cuts back on toxic air pollutants that are giving our children asthma and a raft of other debilitating diseases, even air pollution being linked to Alzheimer's and dementia in adults. Clean energy, affordable clean energy, is one of those benefit multipliers. It works. It's a solution for climate change. It's a solution to air pollution that causes health impacts, adverse health impacts. And whenever you pull many of these solutions, what you find is that gap, that partisan gap, narrows, and you see folks from all across the political spectrum say, yes, that is a good idea. We should be making these switches. So that also is something that gives me hope. But I'll tell you, one bit of the divide is then, how do we put those switches in place? Should it be a government-driven solution, a market-driven solution? That's where I think the real debate is now, of how do we implement and deploy this, frankly, life-saving technology? What's the right role of governments, markets, individuals? And I think that's where the exciting debate should be happening. And it's great to see that shift towards it now.
So let's talk about some of those clean air solutions. Let's maybe start with wind turbines. And as with all technology, when it first started, it wasn't particularly efficient, and the wind turbines themselves were expensive to make and install and maintain, and they were not very recyclable. How has wind turbine technology improved over time? And is that really a reasonable solution to have wind farms?
Yeah, it's a very reasonable solution. And actually, it is the cheapest energy solution out there right now. And so the Lazard cost of electricity analysis finds that whenever you tee up all the different sources of electricity and energy, from fossil powered power generation to renewables like utility scale solar and wind, when you tee them all up, take away those subsidies, and put them on a level playing field, you find that utility scale wind power and solar power are actually the cheapest forms of electricity generation out there. And so it's not only a good solution for addressing climate change and cleaning up our air, but it's also really great for the pocketbook to reduce those household business energy costs. And that is a real hallmark of a lot of climate change solutions, is that it, and that's why I call them benefit multipliers. They help address climate change, they help clean our air, clean our water, protect God's creation, and they are just make good economic sense as well and save us money. And who doesn't want to save money?
Right, that sounds like a market-driven solution too. But does that really include the whole life cycle of the turbines or the solar panels? I mean, like the development of them and the production and recycling the material or dealing with the material when they're at the end of their life cycle?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, because we shouldn't just look at the point emissions, but looking at the, as you said, the life cycle emissions of whatever technology we're looking at. And that really is looking at from the very point of its creation of generating windmills or generating solar panels, generating the oil wells and what emissions come from extracting oil and coal and gas, and then looking all the way to the end of its life cycle of that technology of can we recycle it? And so those analyses are happening. And overall, what we see again is that those renewables have a lower life cycle emissions compared to fossil generated sources of energy. And there's been some really exciting studies and breakthroughs in wind turbine technology that is, there's a new formula out there where those wind turbines can be recycled and repurposed, a breakthrough technology that just came through in the last year or so. I'll also say the same for electric vehicles. That's a big question too. What are the life cycle emissions for electric vehicles compared to fossil powered cars? And again, what you see from their construction all the way to their end is that electric vehicles also have a lower life cycle emissions, even when they're powered by fossil source electricity too. But those are really great considerations, important considerations that we have to think of the whole life cycle emissions and not just at that point sources. And when we do that, by the National Renewable Energy Lab, lots of really great reputable institutions doing these analyses, they find over and over and over again that clean power, clean transportation has lower life cycle emissions compared to fossil powered power and cars.
I want to dig into the psychology a little bit, but behind the Western Church's reluctance to accept the science or maybe some of the clean energy conclusions. Before I do, though, I want to bring in a comment from one of our viewers watching on YouTube. Tacit Reticence says, "What convinced me of the veracity of climate change was the notion of positive feedback loops. Sometimes the public need metaphors and heuristics." So thank you for your comment, Tacit. You know, if I was a pastor for 20 years, and if any of my former parishioners are watching, they're going to think I'm a hypocrite, because I was a culture warrior pastor, and I talked about people like you, doctor, as I used the idea that the metaphor of a watermelon, that when the Berlin Wall fell, Marxists had to find a home to get across their doctrines and their world goals, and they found a home in the environmental movement. And what is green on the outside is red on the inside. And I was living, before I transitioned to reluctantly be a reluctant convert to accept the science behind climate change, I was living in a world, a fallacious world of the fallacy of authority. I had my authorities. I felt I was well read on the subject, but I was really only reading within, confirmation bias. Do you think that a big problem with the church is that we've kind of accepted this kind of dichotomous thinking that if you're not with us, you're against us, and nobody in the scientific world really cares about God anyway? They're godless atheists, so we could dismiss that. And we have our one scientist we could trot out to dismiss whatever it is you're saying. What is the psychology that you've seen in the Western Church as a pastor's wife? And does it make you cringe as a scientist yourself that there seems to be such a lack of faith, if you will, or respect for those who have expertise in their fields or for the science itself?
Yeah, I think, again, as a scientist myself, I view science as simply the study of God's creation. And again, it's something that I came into this science from my relationship with Christ, from a calling of asking God, what assignment do you have for me? And so it is a bit heartbreaking then to come across fellow believers who haven't experienced science in the same way that I have. But the thing is that I can understand that point of view and how we have come to that place. And so it's really interesting that you use the watermelon metaphor of green on the outside, red on the inside. In a little way, I come from deep red East Tennessee, deep red conservative East Tennessee. My father is a hunter. My just kind of down home, good country folks. That is what I grew up in. And so, my dad is a hunter, this is one thing that he always said was that as hunters, we are the best conservationists because we have a real stake in conserving, preserving the land. We love our sport. We love getting out in nature every weekend. And this is something that we want to preserve, conserve, protect. That's where my father goes and actually hears best from God, getting out into the works of his hands, and feels a real strong connection with God when he's out in God's creation. And that's what I think a lot of us find as well. And I think one of the problems is, one, trusted messengers. What we have seen is that I think the legacy of this the historical impact of the dominant message when it comes to faith and science is that they're at odds with each other. We then found that there weren't as many Christians going into the scientific fields. And so then whenever we have these big events, these big problems that are unearthed through science, scientific discovery, like climate change, like the pandemic, where we have very technologically based solutions that come to those things, we don't have those messengers in science who can then speak to the Christian community with authority. We don't have those trusted messengers who can speak to conservatives with authority because for whatever reason, there's a feeling that you're not welcome in the sciences, you shouldn't be there. And that's something that I myself personally have felt why it's so important for me to share my story in the fullness of who I am as both a scientist and a Christian, to help break down that barrier so that more Christians like myself, young Christians who feel this pull to understand the wonderful way that God has made this world and want to study that through science, to make that path smoother, so that we have, again, that diversity of folks in the science field and that can then bring these important evidence-based messages back to our communities so that we can have, again, it's for our health, it's for the safety of our family, the safety of even our nation. And we've got to have these conversations. And whenever Christians aren't in that conversation of also using the evidence-based facts, I think we all suffer the more from it.
I really resonate with what you said about your dad. My husband is a big hunter, fisherman, outdoorsman. He got a deer this morning. The conservation and the communing with God while he's out in the deer stand or out in the in his waders looking for ducks or walking through the fields looking for pheasants, he just has such a connection with God and finds a real community with nature and God and worship, just kind of all intertwined there. So I think that's a really great place to start with this message for some people is looking at their outdoor activities and the importance of preserving the wildlife and the land and not letting it be destroyed by climate change or even a lot of new housing developments and stuff too, to make sure we're preserving areas for the wildlife. What else can we do, like at a community level or a personal level or as part of a church? What are some, I mean, like I can't make there be a wind turbine in my yard or something like that, but what can I do? What can my family do in my community?
Sure. Yeah. I want to answer this in two different ways. And before I get to kind of the individual household and church level solutions, I want to point out those natural solutions that we can really key into. And what some research shows is that by simply protecting God's creation, doing conservation, protecting our forests, our wetlands, our the beautiful places in God's creation, by simply protecting those and harnessing their carbon storage powers, we can get 33% of the way, a third of the way towards addressing climate change that we need. A third of those carbon reductions just by letting nature, letting God's creation do what it does best. And then the question is how, and you really nailed it of talking about development. One of the at least here in the U.S., the biggest driver of deforestation is the development of our lands. And that's because as Arkansas Congressman Bruce Westerman, who is also a forester, has a forestry degree from Yale University, as he always says, one of the reasons for that is because we don't value our forests enough. And so if we can, this is a market-based solution, if we can make a market, increase the market value of our forests to make them worth preserving and stewarding and using well, then we can store more carbon because we're preserving those forests, making sure they're being replanted again when they're harvested instead of being turned into development where a forest is not going to be replanted into. And so I think that's a really great example of one of those market-based solutions using God's creation that then also has that dual benefit, again, that multiplier, benefit multiplier idea. It then also creates this beautiful place where we can go to in our communities to commune with God, to have recreation with our families. And so that's something that we can do in our communities is make sure that we preserve those natural places that are still there. To shift gears and looking at those individual household church level things that we can do. Again, there's a whole buffet of options. And I like to look at these individual level solutions as kind of like our climate tithe or our creation care tithe. Something that we can do, not only because we care for God's creation and want to protect it or we want to address climate change, but because we want to honor God. Because in the first book of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, it says that God put the care of all things that he has made. He's given us responsibility as humans to care for it. And in chapter 2, he's given us a garden to tend to. And by doing different climate solutions, that is us honoring that awesome assignment that God has given us. So a couple examples that I do here in my house is because my house, the things that I buy, that essentially is when I think about what is my garden, that's the garden that God has given me to steward, my household. And so when it came to replacing appliances, I did something simple. I looked for Energy Star appliances that would conserve electricity. And that also, that not only reduces carbon emissions by saving on energy, it also saves my energy bill. So it's good environmental stewardship too. composting is something that seems really small, but it has a lot of benefits of reducing methane emissions from our food waste. And so by composting, we're reducing methane emissions. That is a supercharged greenhouse gas, a greenhouse gas that has more warming potential over a short amount of time compared to carbon dioxide. So reducing our methane emissions has really big bangs for our buck in that. And so by simply composting it, making sure that I'm not wasting those wonderful nutrients in my food waste by sending it packing to the landfill, but making sure it gets reused into gardens here at my house, or dropping it off at a composting spot so that it can be used in community gardens throughout the community. That's a really easy way to start getting involved in those individual solutions. And it's a fun thing that I'm doing with my son as well. When it comes to our churches, we can apply those same principles. We can look to do some energy savings by putting making our buildings more energy efficient, putting solar panels on the roofs. And I'll just give a plug to one of my good friends, Colby May, who has an organization called Energy for Missions. And he's got just such a wonderful perspective of why saving on energy in our churches is actually a missional activity, a mission of God activity. Because the truth is that 30% of our energy bill for our churches, it goes to wasteful energy use. So we could actually claim 30% of that energy use back. That saves 30% of your energy bill at your church that could then be put towards missions. And as a church planter and a pastor's wife, I know that the bills are tight at church. And if I could save by saving 30% of our big energy bill and being able to reinvest that in the kingdom of God and towards the mission of God that he's given our church community, wow, there's so much that we can do. And so what Colby does is he is an energy auditor, and he goes around to churches, finds those places where you could save, and a lot of them are zero cost ways to save to make your building more energy efficient, and helps you reclaim that money that would be sent to the utility instead of to the mission field. And it's just a really incredible way of serving the church and serving the mission of God by looking at our energy savings. It's wise environmental stewardship as well as financial stewardship.
I love that
you,
idea.
Oh, I'm going to make you a little uncomfortable now, Doctor. Somebody referred to Christine and I as a good cop and bad cop, and obviously Christine has the halo. So normally I take the contrarian view at times to get your best answer. I feel bad doing this to you because you're very, I have great respect for you, but I know you're a pastor's wife, so you're used to persecution. So here goes. Are you ready? I'm going to play you a clip from a prominent evangelical voice. Christine said earlier that, you know, whenever we would share information to show people the facts, they always have something to share back, whether it's a Prager University video or some video of a theologian talking. And I'm going to share something with you right now, and I want to get your response, and then I'm going to go in a few other directions. We're going to ask you about maybe some resources people could look into. But recently, the pastor from Moscow, Idaho, Doug Wilson, put up, he does short videos all the time, and the one I'm about to show, he comments on climate change, and he connects it with the coronavirus and vaccines. And I just want you to hear his comments, where he's making an argument that we have to tear down the idols of modern times, and then we'll hear what you say afterwards. So let me cue this up. Again, this is Doug Wilson from Moscow, Idaho.
So the way this works out, in practice, a host of left-wing issues are mysteriously considered to be the outworking of the heart of the gospel, which is justice, and is consequently greeted by the evangelical ruling class with a chef's kiss. Right-wing issues, contrary-wise, also have a heart, which turns out to be black, completely filled with mendacity and greed. But suppose a reformation that dealt with idols looked like one of the reformations we find in Scripture. Quote, "And he took away the Sodomites out of the land and removed all the idols that his fathers had made." 1 Kings 15:12. We must challenge the idols that move nations. Climate change would be one. Fear of a virus would be another. They are propagated by means of stampeding excitement throughout the entire polis. Everybody's talking about it, and if you don't go along with their frenzy, you will soon find out that these idolaters practice church discipline. And this is what is currently happening with the religion of woke. It is a religious faith with all the accoutrements. They have priests, they have high priests, they have catechisms, they have sacrifices, they have temples, they have an index of prohibited books, they have commandments, very strict commandments, they have holiness codes, they have forbidden foods. In fact, they have everything but forgiveness, and that is because they don't have Christ. How could they have Christ when they won't turn to him?
I hate to be this blunt, but when part of the church, and actually kind of a big chunk of the evangelical church, believes that, they don't believe you have Christ. They believe you're an idolater, even though you're a pastor's wife. They dismiss Christians who don't really dot the I and cross the T the way they do. What did you think of what he said there, and how would you combat it if you came on the stage after him and spoke to the same audience?
Sure. Well, I think one thing that I will point out is that when we look at what it means to be saved, it's by professing the lordship of Christ, period. And so we have to, I think it's really important to keep the main thing that our salvation in Christ is by pointing towards his lordship. What are the, and when we're having these discussions, I think it's really important to really focus on what are the pillars of our faith? What are the things that are non-negotiables? For me, God is the creator. And that is a key non-negotiable, is recognizing God as the author of everything, natural, supernatural, the spiritual, as well as the material. God is the author of that. And but sometimes what we see is that we get our, especially on heated subjects, our vision taken away from those main things, those pillars of our faith, and can get distracted by important questions that are out in our in culture, and can begin to set those up as the main things when it comes to judging our salvation or who truly is saved or isn't. And one thing I love looking to Christ. I love looking to, like, what did Jesus do in these situations? And what we find is whenever he's questioned by the religious leaders of the day on certain hot button topics, he always elevates the conversation. He doesn't really, he lifts our eyes to the grander thing that is going on. And so, one thing that I just want to share, again, I'll share kind of how, for me, climate change, addressing climate change is very key. It's a moral issue. It's a kingdom issue. It's actually been a great evangelistic tool that I've been able to use because I get to share my story of how becoming a climate scientist was rooted in my Christian faith of realizing the awesome responsibility that God has given us as humans to take care of all that he has made. That helps me fulfill Matthew 20. The greatest commandment, to love God. One of the ways that I show God that I love him is by loving the things that he made, loving them well. That shows care, respect, honor for God. Second part of that, love your neighbor as yourself. We just have to open up our newspapers, look at the headlines. We just need to open our door now, frankly, to see that increasingly extreme weather is harming our neighbors and it's harming ourselves. Love your neighbor like yourself. This applies to us too. Environmental pollution is harming our neighbors. It's harming our children who are saddled with asthma because of air pollution that harms their lungs even before they are born. These are things that should break our hearts as Christians, should give us that same compassion of Christ whenever he looked out at the sea of crowd, the crowded sea of people, and performed his miracles. We should be moved with the same compassion for these things, especially when we just look at the face of it and the truth of it and peel back the culture war veneer that has been put on climate change. And I will say that there is truth in the clip of this is one thing we talk about at church is there is outside of the church, there's this idea of the searching after trying to establish the kingdom without the king. And I think that is something that we've seen in the past few decades of justice, of seeing the outpourings, what looks the actions of the kingdom, of what the kingdom should look like, of seeing justice reign, and people lifted up out of oppression. Those are all great things and things that we should all be cheering, but we can't do that without the King. We can't do that without Jesus and without the Father and the Holy Spirit as well. And so there is a little bit of that element there of in cultural society outside of Christianity of tracing after the aspects of the kingdom, but without the King. And that is something that I think is really important that we as Christians bring to the conversation is seeing that Jesus said that the kingdom is near and that he was here to bring it. We get to help create that perfect picture of the kingdom.
You've just opened that Pandora's box of theology, and I'm going to jump right into it then and ask you if theology, or at least particular corners of theology, are part of the problem when it comes to this conversation. So I am embarrassed to say this, but when I was a culture warrior, I used to say that it is Christ that sustains the universe. It's kind of like a way to dismiss anything that came from your side of the table. You know, we know that we have Christ who will sustain the universe. And I never really got to the point, that Christ works through us, you know, to do a lot of it. We are his hands and feet. But the theology you heard from the Reformed pastor in the previous clip is they really do believe they're going to bring in the kingdom and then the king will return. But I want to talk to you about the opposite theology of that, the kind of theology that suggests that I've heard people say to me, well, we all know what's going to happen at the end of the book. The world's going to burn anyway. So what you're suggesting is basically just kind of, you know, dusting the furniture on the deck of the Titanic. Why would you care about this place? We're just passing through. This is not our home. We're citizens of heaven and we're heavenly bound. And this world is going to die in a fire, and we've, you know, read that at the end of the book. So why would you put so much devotion into the care of this world? Isn't it a waste of time? So this is theology from both sides of the perspective here. You had the reformer that you just responded to, but now you have the rapture type people who suggest, well, we're temporary here. We're just passing through. And to show this kind of care of this world might suggest that you love this world, as opposed to what John said, that those who love this world don't have the love of the Father in them. How do you respond to that end of the theological table?
Yeah, I'll answer that in two ways. First, let's just look at how Jesus taught us to pray. He said, "Your will be done on earth as in heaven." And that is the vision for at my church. Our vision is kingdom come. We want to partner with you, God, in bringing your kingdom on earth as it is in heaven, bringing heaven down to earth. And so that gives us an idea that this isn't just we're heaven bound, that we only care about that direction. We see Jesus looking the other way, of bringing heaven down to earth, the ways of heaven down to earth. And so that's, I think, the most important thing. Let's look to what Jesus did. What is his example? He brought the miracles of heaven down to earth. And as you said, we get to be the hands and feet of Christ. And so that's why I think it's really important that we remember that it's two ways. Yes, our eternal glory is in heaven, but also we see Jesus bringing the ways of heaven down to earth. And when we look to how do we get to partner with him in the 21st century as Christians, part of that is making sure that we create that healthy environment, that safe climate for everyone to thrive in. And that's where I'm going to segue into my second part of that answer. At the Evangelical Environmental Network, our vision is, again, to make sure that every child has the hope and expectation of a safe climate and a pollution-free world. And I just want to bring in, when I think about why do I care about the here and now, I care about it for my children. I want them to have that healthy environment to grow into. I want them to have that safe climate to thrive in, because life is beautiful here, especially it's the most beautiful whenever we see it in the fullness of Christ with that, the being born again and having that saving, abundant life that Christ offers. He, in John 10:10, it says that Christ came so that everyone may have life and life to the full. Well, I don't think living in polluted air, polluted water, an unstable climate with the threat of extreme weather, that doesn't sound like life to the full to me. And it's certainly not the reality that I want my children to grow in. And frankly, it's not the reality that I want to live in. And God is a good father, and he gives his children good gifts. Whenever he doesn't give a snake whenever his sons and daughters ask for bread, ask for a meal. And so I think that this is a way that we are living into that reality of God's goodness and partnering with him to bring heaven to earth, both for society at large, but most importantly for our loved ones.
I love that idea of thinking of our kids. And it reminds me of some experience that I had, both as a young person and as an adult, and that my kids have had in different church settings, where members of the church setting had a very deep distrust of science and scientists, and even questioned our faith if we didn't hold to kind of an alternative fringe type of view. What's your advice to parents and youth leaders for students and really even for adults in not having that distrust for scientists and not and bringing it back to just faith in Jesus as your faith in Jesus and what you think about science is not a salvation issue? How do you recommend reconciling those two perspectives within a church?
Yeah, I think one of the best ways of doing that is looking for, and this is how it was for me, finding those fellow Christians who were navigating those paths and listening to their stories. For me, a critical moment in my journey to becoming a scientist was finding a fellow scientist in my church community who wasn't just a member, but was a leader in our church. And so as a young Christian at the end of my high school career, looking to go into college and opening my hands and saying, Lord, what do you have for my life? What are you calling into me? I deeply desire to serve you, to lay down my mission and take up your mission. How can you use me? Where will you send me? And overwhelmingly, again and again, inexplicably, I felt this call. You need to go study geology in college. And I didn't know what to do with that. That wasn't my grid or what it looked like to partner with Christ in mission. And so I was on a mission trip with my church the summer before leaving for college. And I was sharing this dilemma with our youth leader, who was leading our team, one of the parents of one of my friends. And I think he just probably asked, like, oh, what are you looking forward to in college? What are you going to study? And I just unload of like this real struggle that I'd been having, because I felt like I had to choose. I felt like I had to choose. Either it was just sort of realizing that stepping into science seemed like, it felt like a controversial choice for someone who was a Christian. I was sharing this with him. I felt like God was calling me to serve him, but also to go into geology, and I didn't know what to do. I felt like I had to make a choice. I couldn't do both. And he looked at me, and he was very patient. He was very kind. And after I kind of gave my whole spiel, he looked at me and said, Jessica, don't you know that I'm a geologist? And my jaw just hit the floor. I had no idea. I had no idea there was another geologist in our church community, let alone one of our leaders. And that, he gave me the encouragement that, again, God puts the desires on our heart, and that we can trust them whenever we've tested them and know that they're from the Lord, and that we simply have to be obedient in all things and all ways to him. And that gave me that clear perspective that even though I didn't see how God was going to work it out in the end, I just needed to be obedient to the calling and the prompting that he had for me. And so that's what led me into science. And we just need more of those stories out there. We need more of there are actually so many Christians in science. There are so many people of faith actually in science. If you look at the latest social science research, of polling scientists, what you find is, because there's this perception that everyone's an atheist in science. And the reality is, if you actually ask scientists about their spiritual views, only 25% would say they are atheists or agnostic. And you find that the vast majority, 75%, recognize some sort of spirituality. And then 25 to 30% identify as Christians. And that was just mind blowing to me, because I felt like I was the odd person out, that I was the only one. And I think that's also because you just kind of stay silent. You at church, sometimes I find myself being hesitant to share that I'm a scientist because I'm afraid of what reception I'm going to get. And then that perpetuates what I think of as kind of the Ken Ham, Richard Dawkins effect, of where those loudest voices in the room say that these two things can't fit together. You have to make a choice. But the reality is when we listen to God and let him speak into our lives. At least this is how it is for me. And so many of my colleagues who I've discovered are scientists and Christians as well, is that they're very, very compatible. And that is, but it's not a message that's getting out to the rest of our church communities, of how deep people of Christian faith are navigating being scientists as well, and that you can have those two together, that you don't have to make that choice.
Doctor, you've been so gracious with your time, especially as a, you know, pastor's wife on a Sunday. I'm going to wrap it up with a comment from a viewer, but before I do, I just want to express our deep affection and respect for all that you do. I know you must have, I'd love to see the psychologist file on you, because you must be a glutton for punishment. You're a pastor's wife and a Christian climate scientist, so you're gonna get a lot of flack. You're above the target. But we had another YouTube viewer say that Merchants of Doubt is a very worthwhile watch and also a well done movie. On that topic, if somebody maybe came from my background on this and they were skeptical of climate science and they thought it was politicized and it was anti-Christian or anti-God, What kind of resources would you recommend for them to get started in the investigation and looking at it? And then maybe as just a tag along question for that, do you see a divide in Christianity, in evangelicalism, by age? Do you kind of see the older generation as a generation that might have to die in the wilderness, but it seems like the younger generation embraces science and so forth, but the other generation, the older generation, is really dug in. Do you see any hope there, or has the reaction to the coronavirus and masks and vaccines kind of shattered that hope?
Sure. Well, in terms of resources, there's an incredible book called The Evangelical's Guide to Climate Change, and it's called Creation Care, An Evangelical's Guide to Climate Change and Environmental Health by Reverend Mitch Hescox and Paul Douglas. And so Paul Douglas is they're both Christians. Reverend Mitch Hescox is a Christian. He comes from a coal mining family in Pennsylvania and is also the president and CEO of the Evangelical Environmental Network. So he brings that perspective as a pastor, someone who's worked in the coal industry, who, again, was led by the prompting of the Lord to realize that we need to switch to clean energy sources, that climate change is real. And then also Paul Douglas, who's a meteorologist and a Christian. It's a really, really incredible book, Caring for Creation, An Evangelical's Guide to Climate Change. I'll also point you towards my organization, the Evangelical Environmental Network, that has a whole host of other resources in addition to that book on our website, so that you can dig in and learn more. That is something that is really been really wonderful to realize, that there actually is a wealth of resources out there of how we can respond as Christians from our own value sets, from our own biblical mandate to be good environmental stewards. There's a lot of great resources out there. And so I just encourage folks to check out creationcare.org for a whole wealth of those. And then just really quickly, when it comes to your question about a generational divide, yes, I do see a change. We've got at our church, we've got a host of young Christians who, for them, climate change is matters to them a lot, is very real to them. They see that this is their future. They see that this is their present. And they want to see something done about it. And this is why it's really important, both as to me as a church leader, because what I've seen is that if we don't address the reality of climate change and bring our solutions and get our young people, provide ways for our young people to get involved, they're going to look elsewhere for how to act on climate. And the thing is that from our own value sets of being called by God to take care of everything that He's made, we stand to offer those really wonderful solutions and really powerful solutions as the church. Because I don't know, if you get the church onto a certain topic and get the full weight of the church behind it, watch out. Incredible things can be done. And that is what we should be doing when it comes to the climate crisis, as well as the pollution crisis. The church needs to get in the game, both as from a moral standpoint, as well as engaging our young people. And what I see is they just don't have the same baggage as maybe some of us older folks have, of seeing it through a political lens, of seeing it through an ideological lens. They just see it for what it is. It's a reality and it's a truth, and we need to do something about it. And the body of Christ is an incredible venue and place that should be bringing our moral voice to make sure that as we address the solutions to climate change, that that we put in place solutions that take care of people, that take care of the problem, and also honors God in the process too.
Well, folks, I'm going to give Christine the last word, but I just wanted to say on the end of that wonderful answer, I'm an old dog. I'm of the generation that'll die in the wilderness, and I did change on this issue. It was painful, I was reluctant, and I think what helped me the most was talking to other Christians who happened to work in the field and who were scientists, and I had great respect for their faith, and they were somebody I'd listened to other than, you know, just nameless scientists that I didn't trust. I was skeptical of. So it was a combination of speaking with them, those scientists, and also the viewer that mentioned Merchants of Doubt. When I watched that documentary, I fell off my chair, I fell off my stool, and I, as somebody who likes to think that he is on a constant pursuit of the truth, I had to make some hard choices there. So I wanted to give Christine the last word and to say goodbye to you, Dr. Mormon. We'd love to have you on again, but thank you for joining us, Christine.
Well, I would also recommend Paul Douglas. He was a meteorologist in our area for a long time, and I do respect him a lot. So really thank you for your time today and your insight. And I hope this can be just a blessing to a lot of people who are who have questions or who are wondering what to think about climate ideas, and if what they've heard, should they be concerned, and what should we do about it? Those are really tough questions. And I think it's going to be more than just changing all of our light bulbs. I think we need to have some deep thoughts on how we should change our behavior. And that's hard. That's hard. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And again, as a talking about solutions, having conversations like this is one of the number one solutions that we can have, because everyone has an important voice and stake in the conversation about climate, as well as the solutions to climate change. And that's the way that we're going to get through this, is in cooperation, in coordination. And thank you so much for your all's courage in putting this conversation forward. It's been a real pleasure to join you, to speak with you, speak with the viewers. It's really been an honor and a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us, folks. We'll see you again in, is it next week, Christine?
Next week. Next week, we have Roger Weens, who has worked on a number of different devices on Mars rovers and on the Genesis space vehicle that collected particles from the sun. So he'll be on next week.
So we look forward to that. Thank you for joining us, folks. Goodbye.